Welcome. You are listening to a recording provided for the use of those who are blind and or print impaired. Materials or items read on Airs LA and the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service are the copyrighted property of the original authors and publishers. No unauthorized use or duplication is permitted. Welcome to episode 335 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening show developed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host and producer, and I look forward to sharing with you over the next 40 minutes updates to our local garden scenes and recent articles about gardens, plants, and designers, both in California and around the world. Gardens are in my DNA. I was raised in a family of gardeners, and my grandparents and mother handed down a love of flowers, of orchids, and of roses, among many other gifts. I have been an inveterate gardener for years, from that first six-pack of marigolds I bought at Home Depot in suburban Connecticut to laying out birthday rose gardens, planting fruit trees, and rescuing overgrown and underloved gardens, as well as building my own garden library with classic design texts, memoirs and commentaries from gardeners and designers alike, and, well, just a few glossy coffee table indulgences. I have spent years getting to know California's Mediterranean garden landscapes, plants, and climate, even as I have fallen for English and continental garden design traditions, grown fond of the particularities and peculiarities of succulents, which perform so well in our climate, and learned to love and respect the quiet power of a Japanese garden. I have been active in local garden societies and visited botanical gardens across the country and around the world, believing not only in the benefits of gardening itself, but of being in the garden, and of being charmed by that special alchemy of plants, climate, soil, design, place, space, light, and shade. Gardens are a place where we can become more alive and more connected with the world we share with others. And as the Good Book reminds us, it all began in a garden. Welcome to this week's show. We start with Robin Lane Fox's most recent column, published on the 12th of March in the Financial Times of London, with tasks appropriate for mid-March. After all the rain, it's time to mulch. The next two weekends are an opportunity to future-proof the garden by keeping moisture in the soil, blocking weeds, and deterring slugs and snails. Wet and early are the words that best sum up gardens in Britain. Yet again, they are ahead of their previous pattern. Narcissi used to come out at the beginning of April, and so did magnolias. In my rural orbit, flowers are a month ahead of themselves compared with the turn of the millennium. London, I imagine, will soon see roses flowering on walls. This new style non-winter is not Mediterranean, but it is certainly a change. The risk, as ever, is a spring frost, as it will turn the flowers on magnolias and camellias a dirty brown. I never remember such a season, not just for its accelerated calendar, which is even more pronounced than last year's. There's also the matter of all that winter rain. It opens an opportunity which I urge you to take. The opportunity is mulching. The next two weekends are the ideal time to cope with it. A mulch is a layer of straw, compost, leaf mold, chopped waste, or bark. It has to be spread on the surface of flower beds to a depth of at least 2 inches. It may sound a bother, but it will save no end of work later in the year. Its primary aim is not aesthetic. It is to conserve damp in the soil underneath it and to block out weeds there too. After all the rain, it is a fair bet that we are in for another long, dry spring and summer. By mulching now, you will slow the loss of the wet that has tipped down since mid-November. A mulch is far less valuable if applied when a dry spell is underway. The immediate aftermath of a long, wet phase is the ideal time for putting it in place. For smaller gardens, I recommend a new arrival, Thompson & Morgan's IncrediMulch Plus. It is based on chopped bark and FSC certified, attesting that it has been responsibly sourced from sustainably managed forests. it will block light from reaching any weeds underneath it because it has been chemically fused. This fusion also stops it from blowing around the garden like straw. My basic cheap mulch, wherever I do not have to look at it all day. IncrediMulch is a feed as well as a blocker because it has been fortified with balanced nutrients, breaking down into 15 parts of nitrogen, 9 of phosphorus, and 12 of potash. Nitrogen promotes fresh green growth, and IncrediMulch's proportion of it is much higher than most other popular fertilizers, whether tomerite or fish, blood and bone, or even Growmore, one of my spring staples. Growmore's proportional breakdown is 7-7-7. The aim for these chemicals is to be released from IncrediMulch slowly during 6 months, responding to rising temperatures and intermittent rain. In last year's long dry spell, however, slow release became no release for weeks on end. In warm, wet summers, by contrast, slow release became a rush. As IncrediMulch is high on nitrogen, it will promote green spring growth if spring is showery. If spring is very wet, the nitrogen will be hyperactive. Slow releasing is not an exact science. Prices online vary, but as of writing, 2 50-liter bags are on sale from Thomson and Morgan for £30 plus UK delivery. 2 bags ought to suffice for beds and pots in small urban gardens, especially as Thomson and Morgan advises a depth of no more than 3 centimeters. The company explains that it will last for 2 years, needing only a modest topping up in spring 2027. It suits vegetables as well as flowering plants and is neutral, neither acid nor alkaline. Mushroom compost may seem to be a cheaper alternative, but it is usually very alkaline. It needs to be stockpiled in the open for several months so that rain can wash out much of its alkalinity. An alternative is Strulch, used in RHS gardens and formerly the Eden Project. It is mineralized wheat straw that looks pale brown when applied. It has won keen supporters in the past 5 years and is best bought directly from strulch.co.uk if you need it in bigger quantities. Thomson & Morgan is offering 2 100-liter bags for £30, delivering being an extra charge. Strulch itself offers bigger bags of bigger batches at rates which bring the cost down. Bigger gardens could easily absorb 40 of these bigger bags, each holding 13.5 kilograms, enough to treat up to 175 square meters. A load of this size is priced by Strulch at £375 plus VAT, again with delivery as an extra. Like IncrediMulch, this mineralized straw feeds plants, blocks weeds, and deters slugs and snails, as they do not like sliming over its surface. It too has a neutral pH, suiting it for use among azaleas and camellias. If you use outside contractors to help with your big garden, remember that a sum spent up front on Strulch in spring will save many pricey hours of labor for weeding the rest of the year. Mulch is not just a matter of throwing spent matter all over a border. Remember that perennial weeds must be killed off first, as most of them will survive or even thrive with a blanket of mulch over them. You will never kill bindweed by mulching it, not even if you apply mulch at a depth recommended by some of its apostles of 6 to 9 inches deep. I do not have enough home compost to do so, and I cannot afford enough of a supplement either for a big rural garden. Even if I did, I doubt it would kill existing ground elder. Think before you mulch. Do not mulch drought-loving plants, especially those with silver leaves. In borders, phloxes love to be mulched, but yellow daisy-flowered anthemas do not. Do not mulch alpine plants either, unless they are plants from low alpine meadows, and even then few of them like to be covered up to their necks. The right way to surface a bed of alpine plants is to use horticultural grit, available in bags from Westland and other sources. Grit is the alpine gardener's godsend. A surfacing of it round my dianthus plants have kept them all alive in the winter wet. They hate. It has been a bad year to be a crocus, and an even worse one to be an ungritted alpine. What about roses? They respond so well to mulching that this weekend I will be mulching mine, old and new. I will put down a soluble feed for roses first, having just bought Top Rose Rose and Shrub Feed, a stalwart from the maker Phostrogen. The company recommends 28 grams, approximately a handful, round each established rose, and in the bottom of holes in which newly planted roses' roots are to be spread out. I will approximate a handful round each of my long-established musk roses, planning to apply a second dose after flowering. Do not increase the dose thinking you will do more good. Roses resent overfeeding. After top-rosing them, I will not use rotted manure as well. I will just use leaf mold ready to hand beneath my beech trees. I will then stand back, admiring the dark surface in which worms will love to squirm. A Sunday well spent. The most recent column by Robin Lane Fox, published in the Financial Times of London on the 12th of March, after all the rain, it's time to mulch. Our next article by Lottie Delamain was published on the 14th of March in the Financial Times and brings a different perspective to the Golden State. Here's the secret to gardens with laid-back California cool. Terremoto's low-intervention approach allows for something missing in contemporary landscape design, serendipity, and a sense of the unknown. Terremoto has carved out its own path. Central to the Californian landscape design company's credo is the question of how to do less, both how to use less and how to solve design problems in the least number of moves. As often as possible, we try to come to peace with existing conditions, says David Godshall, who founded the studio with his late design partner Alain Pauvois. Instead, we are asking, can we live with it? Over the past 15 years, the company has become the go-to for clients looking for gardens with ecological and ethical integrity, including the actress Kirsten Dunst and the Beastie Boys' Adam Horovitz. Today, the 27-person company operates from offices in Los Angeles and San Francisco, with a portfolio of projects ranging from the gardens of Frank Lloyd Wright's masterpieces to lo-fi community projects to the grounds of public museums. Each design is unified by a confident, restrained palette of plants and materials that, in spite of those restraints, feel abundant and alive. This low-intervention approach allows for something missing in contemporary landscape design, serendipity, and a sense of the unknown. We're using local materials. We're prioritizing ecology. We're not so fixed on drawing plans, and instead beauty emerges, rather than becomes imposed, Godshall says. It expands your aesthetic imagination. That's the joy. In Museum Garden, a residential project in L.A., that meant keeping the hard structures and ugly, in Godshall's words, walls, and finding ways to bridge the gap between the existing garden and the client's desire for a usable, beautiful space. Simple additions were introduced, including a ladder to link the terraces and a simple metal pergola to sit under and enjoy the view, while on-site materials were reused to blur the existing hardscaping into the pavers, paths, and places to sit. The resulting garden has an aesthetic all its own, more novel than a pure new build, and one deeply rooted to its place. Terremoto's methods certainly diverge from the historical approaches to landscape design, which, in Godshall's words, mostly imposed beauty on a garden or required beauty of a garden, whether through the geometry of French neoclassicism to celebrate human supremacy over land or the more pastoral English garden-making traditions. Even modern gardens are very much impositions of geometry onto land. While the opportunity of a blank slate is appealing for any designer, Godshall believes it can also be a form of cultural erasure. Keeping what's there, whether it's a host of unruly pines or old concrete foundations, also closes the materials loop and dramatically reduces the need for new inputs. This could be challenging in L.A., as Story Wiggins, a partner who joined Terremoto in 2016, explains. This is a bit of a reframe for most people. Especially where we are, the sense of history is not as present in the built environment or as appreciated as a source of beauty as it is in other parts of the world. The company recently decided to stop building conventional swimming pools because of the environmental costs. That has yielded new solutions and responses that would never have been on the table had they not opened up that conversation, such as outdoor showers and wooden plunge pools, and other ways to cool down in the heat of an LA summer. There are lots of options as long as people are open-minded, says Gottschall. Sea Ranch Lodge, a visionary residential community built in the 1960s, is an archetype of West Coast minimalism. When Terremoto was asked to reimagine the 53-acre site as part of a broader modernization project in 2019, it was an opportunity to apply its restrained approach to a larger canvas. That meant forensic study of the wider landscape to ensure the planting design sat invisibly within existing plant communities. Hyperlocal species were selected along with materials that were found on site or nearby, such as fallen trees and boulders. The resulting scheme looks like it has always been there, so much so that the designer's hand was invisible even to some of the design review committee. We did very little on this project, and that's probably what we're most proud of, says Gottschall. Is it hard to justify fees on projects where the work they do is largely invisible? 100% this approach is not for everyone, says Wiggins. It takes a certain sensitivity to understand the power of simplicity and understatement. And sometimes the site itself calls for something more flamboyant. So we typically employ the illegible approach when it really feels right for the project. I do think we are lucky in that most of our clientele comes to us because of what we do. For a garden design practice, Terremoto is unusually transparent about its build process. In the early days, with little completed work to show, the studio shared images of projects under construction. We just started being explicit about process and construction on our website and in the way that we portrayed our work, Gottschall explains. The images, candid mid-build shots depicting the people, machines, and labor involved in garden making, were refreshing to see in an industry that is obsessive about before and after, and the big reveal of the immaculate, finished garden. The images also bring the people who are building the garden into view. In California, it's mostly Latino immigrants who work in the landscape industry, and those who only show the finished garden are rendering their contribution invisible, says Gottschall. The landscape industry's labor acknowledgement, or lack thereof problem, by no means exclusive to the U.S., also extends to fair pay, a topic that Terremoto raises early on with clients. We advocate for clients to pick contractors for their skill, craft, and knowledge, rather than selecting based on the bottom line, says Wiggins. Invariably, clients are won over when the project unfolds and they see for themselves how much the landscaping builders bring to a project. While Terremoto's environmental and social integrity has become its calling card, aesthetics remain paramount. The ethical underpinnings of our work are a draw for people, but at the end of the day, the proposition is simple. We aim to make beautiful gardens, says Wiggins. This article is a revised and expanded extract from Lottie Delamain's Gardens That Can Save the World, published by Thames and Hudson, and for sale for £30. The article by Lottie Delamain was published on March 14th in the Financial Times of London. Here's the secret to gardens with laid-back California cool. We turn next to an article by Lauren Invick, published on the 6th of March in the Financial Times of London, Bloom and Bust. Can Sarah Raven regrow her garden business? The plants woman who single-handedly brought dahlias back into fashion and nurtured the UK through COVID had become a perennial in the horticultural firmament. Then it all went wrong. It is a thoroughly wet morning at Perch Hill, Sarah Raven's farm in East Sussex, and for once there is not much to see in the cutting garden. The soil and the hawthorn hedges are bare. A few hellebores and snowdrops are all that are in flower. Raven appears, encased in a dark anorak, and when she offers me into the buff stone farmhouse, her husband, the writer Adam Nicholson, and her two dogs, Dusty and Curly, come to greet us. She announces that it's her birthday. She is 63. Technically, she's not working, but she has been answering emails since 5 a.m., and after our meeting, we'll record two podcast episodes before making dinner, a venison ragu recipe she is testing for a forthcoming cookbook. The open plan space that flows from the living room to the kitchen is unexpectedly modest for someone of Raven's silver-spooned background. Her mother, Faith Raven, inherited the 35,000-acre Arn Tornish estate in Scotland, and that of Nicholson, the grandson of Sissinghurst creator Vita Sackville-West and Harold Nicholson, and a baron who does not use the title. Its sofas are covered in slips and patterned cushions over well-worn rugs. She makes two cups of coffee and pours them into slipware mugs. Raven is the closest thing the UK has to a Martha Stewart, a pinafore-clad grande dame of garden and stove who single-handedly ushered dahlias back into fashion and shaped the national taste for bright, floriferous, abundant, and slightly messy gardens. She has been a presenter on BBC's Gardener's World, the broadcaster's flagship TV show on home horticulture, created two gardens at the RHS Chelsea Flower Show, and published 15 books on gardening and cooking. Her latest, A Year of Cut Flowers, A Life of Growing and Arranging for All Seasons, is out this month. Hundreds of visitors descend on her home on open days to admire her bulb lasagnas, pots layered with a succession of bulbs such as crocuses, narcissi, and tulips to keep them flowering for months, and immaculately staked and covered vegetables. Pick up a vase or a packet of seeds in the shop and dine in the large greenhouse erected in early 2024. Episodes of her podcast have been downloaded more than 10 million times. At the heart of her many endeavors is the mail-order seed business she started at her kitchen table in 1997 that had, by its peak in 2021, expanded into a 27 million pounds a year e-commerce enterprise, spanning live plants, bulbs, seeds, tools, garden furniture, and home decor. Few UK nurseries or garden centers have made a true success of the internet. Raven and her team have created a lush living catalog organized into collections that make filling a pot or choosing a selection of winter salad vegetables a simple and enjoyable exercise, and one that is accessible to those just starting out. Beginner gardeners and busy people just long to have someone who can shortcut them to something reliable, Raven says. Sarah has created a style that is synonymous with bold exuberance and color, says garden designer Tom Stewart Smith. 25 years ago in British gardening, that would have applied something rather brash and crass. She made it stylish and brought that to an extraordinarily wide audience. It's quite hard to think of tulips and dahlias without thinking of Sarah. Sarah brought cut flowers back into fashion and made it a business, adds Robin Lane Fox, the FT gardening columnist of 5 decades. It made people be more colorful and grow their own flowers. And so it came as a shock when, last July, the business went into administration. Buoyed by soaring sales over the pandemic, the company had overextended itself by buying its main supplier, a plant nursery and distribution center in Lincolnshire, in an all-cash deal in 2021. After lockdowns lifted, sales fell to £23 million in 2022 and to £18 million in 2023. The final straw came last spring when HM Revenue and Customs rescinded a VAT claim demanding immediate payment of a £1.2 million bill. We couldn't borrow that, she says. The business also had significant operational issues. Customers took to Trustpilot and other forums to complain of receiving the wrong plants, empty seed packets, and erratic shipping times. I now look at her website for inspiration, note down the plants, and buy elsewhere, a user on Mumsnet, an online platform for parents, wrote last July. Raven and Nicholson, aided by family funds, were able to buy the company out of administration. Now they are laboring to pay back creditors and ensure the future of the business. Can they succeed? Sarah Raven's fascination with plants began nearly as soon as she could walk. cultivated by her father, John Earl Raven, a classics don at Cambridge University and an expert amateur botanist. Holidays were spent at his side scouring the foothills of the Dolomites, the hilltops of Crete, and the western shores of the Hebrides in Scotland in search of rare wild flowers. Sarah was encouraged to press what she found in a journal, labeling each entry with its Latin name and where it had been discovered. It was quite an enriching thing, not only learning about plants, but also, when you're one of five, hanging out with my dad on my own, she says. He died when she was 17. Raven has kept alive his passion for observing plants in the wild, which informs how she gardens at home. Seeing wild tulips baking on dry boulders in Crete inspired her to begin planting cultivated tulips under her apple trees and dry hedges at Perch Hill, for example, to see if they might perennialize there. They have. Her garden is a testbed for constant trials and experiments that informs her books and the stock on her website. Like the late plantswoman Beth Chetto, she combines a rare sense of beauty with the rigor of science. It wasn't until after Raven had qualified as a doctor and given birth to her second daughter that she came to see gardening as a vocation. In 1994, she and Nicholson purchased Perch Hill, a 90-acre farm on poor soil where they laid out a garden that now spans about an acre and a half. Nicholson drew the paths and beds. Raven chose the plants. "I'm a real botanist. I look down, while Adam looks broadly," says Raven. "We're quite traditional in that sense. Vita and Harold designed Sissinghurst the same way." Raven threw herself into the cutting garden, where she focused on maximizing productivity. She soon abandoned stalwarts such as peonies in favor of annuals grown from seed, such as cosmos and snapdragons, which yielded far more flowers per square meter and yet were rarely grown. Those findings became the foundation for her first book, The Cutting Garden, 1996, a bestseller that launched her into the horticultural firmament. It led to a stint on Gardener's World and to a show garden with the designer Pip Morrison at Chelsea, which the judges snubbed. "I cried for 3 days," she says. "They said my color combinations were vulgar and crass." But the book's success gave her the confidence to set up the seed business. She commissioned artists to illustrate her catalogs. Orders came via checks in the post. Pottery, tools, root trainers, dahlia tubers, and tulip bulbs gradually joined the mix. After Raven's black dahlias were mentioned in a newspaper article, the postman showed up with a huge mailbag with 300 orders for the 120 tuber collections. That's when we started to learn about merchandising and the science of supply and demand. She continued to publish, expanding beyond cut flowers, with titles on cultivating produce and cooking with it. Becoming a public figure made her uneasy. "I didn't love Sunday in the co-op, getting a croissant, no makeup, somebody taking a photo," she says. She acknowledges that people often find her standoffish or rude. "The local baker and the primary school think I'm snooty and superior, but I'm just not a schmoozer. I'm not charming." Raven chalks up her early success to her tried and tested approach. In food, there was Delia Smith, Mary Berry, Nigella Lawson. They were all home cooks and prided themselves on being that. "You might not like every bit they did, but you knew they were reliable," Raven observes. "Maybe that's what I provided. I didn't train at Wisley or Kew. I was just gardening, just wanting beautiful things that looked and tasted good." In 2004, Nicholson's father, Nigel, became ill, and they moved with their daughters to Sissinghurst in Kent. Raven commuted to Perch Hill daily to manage the business. The family's relationship with the National Trust proved fraught, as chronicled in the 2009 BBC documentary Sissinghurst, and in 2012 they returned to Perch Hill. These days she prefers to spend her evenings at home, cooking. "I'm a family bod." People say, "At 63, why don't you retire?" "I've had to think about that," Raven says, recalling the months before her company entered administration. "My staff, my reputation, and my creditors were the main thing that made me want to carry on, though my reputation took one hell of a denting." 100 companies and potential investors were invited to bid for the business last summer. Raven says she succeeded by outlining a plan that, in the view of the administrators, ensured the continuity of the company and kept most of the staff on the payroll. The company now has about 60 employees, down from 110 when it entered administration. It was, says Raven, the most difficult 3 months of my adult life. I had trouble sleeping and I lost a lot of weight. Dominic Rose, a former executive at fashion resale site Depop, who became chair of Sara Raven in 2023, says the process has made the company more streamlined, with a focus on reliably profitable product categories, bulbs, plants, hardware, and seeds, that leaves much of the growing and all of the order fulfillment to third parties. Revenues are rising again, and the nursery and its fulfillment center are up for sale. We've gotten rid of high-risk things, adds Raven. A garden table or even a chair, do you want to get that from us? Probably not. To tackle the quality issues, Raven says the company is refining its supplier list. It also stopped selling plugs, young plants shipped in a couple of centimeters of compost, after too many orders failed in last spring's heat. If the courier leaves them in the van over the weekend, they get dried out and die, says Rose. Customer contact levels were down 50% from last year, he adds, suggesting its customer service team is fielding fewer complaints. Promotions are frequent. Last week, everything on sararaven.com was 30% off, plus free delivery. The previous week, all dahlias were marked down 25%. It works. It is the reality, says Raven. I used to really fight about over-emailing and over-discounting, but now I've piped down. In putting the nursery up for sale, Raven has had to put aside her vision of a vertically integrated business where she grows, sells, and ships her own plants. But she still does the legwork integral to her tried-and-tested brand proposition, traveling to suppliers in Europe 4 times each spring, first to visit breeders of hellebores and narcissus, then tulips, and back again for alliums. Everything is trialed at Perch Hill for 2 years before it is photographed and put up for sale on the website, she says. But there are few intellectual property protections in horticulture, and much of what Raven does is copied by other online sellers, down to the blue pinafores in the background of photos advertising dahlia collections. A best-selling dahlia named for her daughter, Molly Raven, was sold in the U.S. without authorization last year. We are copied massively, she says. We do all the R&D, do all the trips. And a few companies see what we've ordered, copy our collections, and undercut us by 10 to 15%. It's a messy old game. I don't want to get into a supermarket price war, she continues. We have to retain the belief that we must invest and spend money on doing what we believe is important, breeding new plants and new varieties. It does upset me, but I just have to keep going. But it may be the end of us. The other e-commerce companies are taking market share. Rose is less concerned about the online competition. 90% plus of all gardening spend in the UK is done at garden centers, says Rose. That's really where our customers are. At Perch Hill, close to the house, Raven and her team have carved out a breeding area to develop exclusive dahlia cultivars. Nancy, named for a granddaughter, will be a massive bestseller, she predicts. Another, Strawberry Sarah, is actually scented. Sweet peas are doing really well because others don't do them. Her new book is, like her first, about cut flowers, but enriched with 3 decades of experience. I'm very proud of my first book, but it was a young woman's book. I'd only been growing cut flowers for 3 years. Raven says it's the learning and having the opportunity to share what she learns for the benefit of other gardeners and wildlife that keeps her going. We notice that Verbena bonarensis is still feeding blue tits in January, and we record it. It's why I carry on. But, she says, referring to the administration ordeal, it might have been easier to move to Crete. A Year of Cut Flowers, A Life of Growing and Arranging for All Seasons by Sara Raven will be published on March 12th. Published by Bloomsbury, the price in England is £30. An article by Lauren Invick, published on the 6th of March in the Financial Times of London, Bloom and Bust, Can Sara Raven Regrow Her Garden Business? this week with an excerpt from a long piece, The Column for Beauty, that was published in The Gardener's Bedbook by Richardson Wright. The excerpt begins, "There is told a story of an Arab who had a famous garden, and who, on being obliged to move away from that section of the country, offered to sell it to a friend. Being a good businessman, the friend set about making an appraisal of it, and eventually he brought his figures to the owner. All the items were set down, the cost of the grading and the masonry, the water pipes and the pool, the cost of the walls and the arbor and the trees and shrubs and vines and flowers. After studying it a while, the Arab said, 'This is no appraisal, my friend. You have not appraised the perfume of my orange groves, nor the glories of my iris, nor the exquisite aroma of my spice trees. You have not appraised the song of the birds that make their home in my garden. You've said nothing of the tinkle of water from my fountain. The material things that you have priced are merely the framework for the beauty that gives it life and character. But alas, these things you never can appraise. Their value will depend entirely on your capacity for enjoying them.' In so many ways can beauty surround us that a man may soon beggar himself in acquiring them, and yet the capital expenditure for that chair, which has a beauty of line raised above the dull, commonplace herd of chairs, those curtains, that interesting wallpaper, that deep pile carpet, that rug laboriously and wonderfully created on the loom, may we not say that such capital expenditures are justified so long as we have the capacity for enjoying the beauty that is in them? The well-planted garden, the well-designed house, the etching on the wall, the linen and crystal and silver on the table, the books on the shelves, all must be bought ever remembering that their value to us far outweighs their costs. Indeed, many of us who cannot afford to own them will deliberately sacrifice things others consider essential in order to surround ourselves with their beauty. The more we enjoy those things that are beautiful, the more we realize that the very best part of life finds no column in the material registers of accountancy. There is no place for the song of birds, or the music of water, or the sunlight flooding a lovely room. There is no place for the grand sweep of a roofline or the noble strength of a chimney. Man has not yet devised a budget wherein such things can be calculated. The seven senses refuse to stay put in a column. There are no accountant books for the heart. Shakespeare asked, 'Where is fancy bred? Or in the heart? Or in the head? How begot? How nourished?'" An excerpt from The Gardener's Bedbook by Richardson Wright and his long piece, At the End of March, The Column for Beauty. That wraps up episode 335 of Green and Growing in the Garden, the weekly gardening program designed for the Los Angeles Radio Reading Service. Please send us your comments at www.larrs.org or email us at oneword laradioreading@gmail.com. Give us suggestions of gardens or stories to follow, your thoughts on a favorite story you heard, or what you think of the broadcast itself. Gardens are not just plant, soil, and irrigation. They speak to us of the world around us, even as we try to create order and impose structure. They connect us to our landscape and to the cycles of nature. They teach us patience, stewardship, and fortitude. They offer possibilities of beauty, of persistence, sometimes even of transcendence. And they open our senses to both the heart and the soul, to being alive, to being connected with other gardeners, other gardens, and other times. Whether in a container or in pots on a balcony in the city, in a defined, dedicated garden area, planted around a suburban house or in an urban courtyard, or in spaces surrounded by trees, landscape, and open sky, gardens are precious indeed, no matter where they are. I'm Hugh Ralston, your host. Thanks for joining us. Until the next time.